Hello, you're listening to Section D. Monocle 24 is a dedicated weekly design show. I'm Yolaine Goffin and I'm standing in for Josh Fennert. Today, we're jetting off on a Californian vacation with a new exhibition charting the Golden State's vast contributions to the discipline of design. We'll find out if Apple and apps really are the outcome of California's freewheeling radical past.
The ideals of Silicon Valley are definitely rooted in the hippie counterculture, and that's really what we're trying to say in this show.
Next, we'll talk airports and skyscrapers with the co-CEO of design and architecture super practice, Gensler.
That's what we consider a successful project, is that when it does enhance the human experience of the individuals and the communities that will use that place.
And we'll speak volumes with Aubrey Powell and his new book, charting record cover designs, and the work of his influential studio, Hypnosis. That's ahead on Section D with me, Yolaine Goffin. Now, California is unquestionably a cultural juggernaut. But when design is mentioned, it's often the state's boxy modernist houses that are discussed. It's welcome news, then, that a new exhibition at London's Design Museum has focused on how California's history has made it into one of the world's most progressive design hubs. From low-slung chopper-style motorcycles to Google's self-driving Waymo model car and Apple's first cumbersome computers, the exhibition covers about 300 items, telling stories of the Gold State's impact on the trajectory of design today. To find out more, Section D's regular host Josh Fennert paid a visit and spoke with Kyle Osbrink, a curatorial research assistant and, of course, a Californian who helped collate the collection.
My name is Kyle Osbrink. I'm a curatorial assistant at the Design Museum for the California Designing Freedom Exhibition. And right now we are standing in front of the Waymo autonomous self-driving car and a replica of the Captain America motorcycle from the film Easy Rider.
So already we have a sense of the dramatic exhibition that you've pulled together. You yourself are a native Californian. And in taking up this theme, what do you think these two items start by saying as people first walk into this exhibition? What does a self-driving car say about California?
Well, basically, our guiding principle for putting the show together was about tools of personal liberation. And we wanted to make a big statement as soon as people walked into the show about what that really means. And putting these two vehicles side by side speak to the two different forms of personal liberation from the 1960s to present day. So starting in the 1960s, you know, the idea of personal liberation and personal freedom was two wheels and the open highway. Contrasting that to today's idea is more about the freedom from having to drive to work or drive really anywhere, where you can get in a car that comes to your location that does not have a steering wheel, and giving over your control of the vehicle to artificial intelligence to have it take you where you need to go.
And as we look at these as just even visual clues about the time from which they come, we've got a kind of low-slung, old glory clad chopper and a kind of little car that looks a little bit like a British policeman's helmet. I mean, what does that tell you about the priorities and how they've changed? You've got this sense of rebellion at the start and then almost this sense of consensus at the end that we can all work together.
I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, the ideals of Silicon Valley are definitely rooted in the hippie counterculture, and that's really what we're trying to say in this show, that the ideas of that were established back in the 1960s of dropping out, of rebellion, of self-sufficiency, of living off the grid, these are all the sort of founding principles that guided a lot of the tech industry that produced all the products that we use today all the time. And that's really the thrust of the show.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part.
So we've walked a few paces across the room and we're confronted by some extremely bright printed images. Maybe you could tell us what we can see here.
Well, again, starting in the 1960s, we have a work by Corita Kent, who was a practicing nun in Los Angeles. She taught the Immaculate Heart College art department, and she created a lot of pop art-influenced posters and prints that were very much about political activism and spirituality. And they were contemporary of, you know, the pop artists of the day, like Andy Warhol, Lichtenstein, those kinds of people. And they used a lot of, you know, contemporary and everyday kind of imagery and mixed it with poetry, with scripture, and with empowering messages that were very emblematic of the time period that they came from.
And if we fast forward, where do you pick up this thread in modern day California?
We're now standing in front of a poster by Shepherd Fairey, which he produced after the election, the 2016 election. And this was very much a response to a lot of the sort of negative aspects that came out of the election, a lot of feelings of division and feelings of resistance and protest that arose out of the results of the election.
Oddly, that religious theme pops up again. I mean, here Yes. We see a woman with her head covered in a headscarf, which is the American flag. And, you know, before the thread I suppose you're picking up on is that thread of religion, that it's never too far from debates in American society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the statement that he's making here, it's a whole series called We the People. This is the woman in the star-spangled hijab is one. Basically, it depicts a series of women of various ethnicities, various backgrounds, and various faiths who are all depicted in a very empowering way. This one in particular says, "We are greater than fear." And one of the things that Shepherd Fairey did with these posters that was very unique was that he made all these posters available for download for free so that anyone could download them, print them, take them to protests, take them to rallies. It's a democratization of his work, which is sort of the antithesis to a lot of artists who want to view their works as very precious and very unique. He wanted to make this available for the people for whatever ends that they wanted to use it for. And it ended up being a very successful campaign that was used a lot. You saw it a lot in the women's marches. Again, it's connecting back to the counterculture movement of resistance, of empowerment, of speaking your voice, and but using a very, you know, modern 2017 interpretation of that using technology.
And just as the Beach Boys soundtrack fades away in the background, I suppose we, like the Waves, should go on to your third pick from the exhibition.
Great.
So we've wandered a few paces over to what would probably look to people that have grown up or adolesced recently like enormous concrete building blocks, but I'm assured these used to be the height of technology. We've got some Apple computers from way back.
Yeah, so we have two computers which represent sort of the inception of the modern computing PC movement that we know today. Our first computer that we have here is a computer from 1981 made by Xerox. It's called the Star. This was the first computer that used a graphic user interface.
By doing no more than operating this unique pointing device, which we call the mouse, and depressing the appropriate key, you can pull out a folder, open it, and select a document.
All the actions that we use on today's computers that we take for granted, like windows, dragging and dropping files into different windows, files, having a screen that is white with a black typeface that looks like a page. These were all completely new concepts in 1981. And as you can see, the computer that they built that had this, it has a mouse, it has a separate keyboard, but it's a big, massive thing. This computer also cost $75,000 when it was brand new in 1981, so it was a very high-end thing. But then you fast forward 3 years to 1984, and you have the Apple Macintosh, which was basically the democratization of the personal computer. You can see it's much more approachable, it's much smaller, it's more affordable, and it was more personal.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
We also have a notebook by Susan Kare, who sketched out a lot of the, and designed a lot of the original Mac icons that we're so familiar with today.
So these are things like a pointing finger to signify that you're moving your cursor onto the right thing.
Yeah, things like the pointing finger, the trash can, the paintbrush, the little smiling Mac icon that shows when the computer boots up. Those were all created by Susan Kerr. And she hand-drew all these things pixel by pixel on graph paper, which you can see here. And this really helped to make the computer approachable. It made it more human. It made it so that people could understand it better. You didn't have to be a coding geek to use a computer anymore. Suddenly anyone could use a computer and they could make all these amazing things.
And the last question, because I know you're very busy, the exhibition has been extremely well hyped. We're here on a weekday afternoon and there's lots of people milling around. I suppose it's two questions in one. One, how did you describe or how did you start thinking about the scope of what you were going to include in the exhibition? And two, what would you like the legacy to be? What would you like people to think after they've left or to know more about?
Well, you know, one of the main objectives of this show was to basically present California's influence on design from a modern day perspective. You know, there have been a lot of exhibitions about California design that have dealt mostly with mid-century modernism, about the world of Charles and Ray Eames, architects like Richard Neutra. While that is all wonderful, wonderful stuff, we wanted to really look at how California's design influence affects us today. You know, picking up the story from the 1960s, bringing it forward to present day and even into the future. That's what we really wanted to talk about. And, you know, it's something that when thinking about technology with user interface, with our online lives that we live now, it's so obvious and it's so there, but it's not really anything that people really talk about much. So we're trying to delve a little deeper and get people to realize that all of the stuff that we use every day without even thinking about it is all the result of this sort of cultural ideas that were rooted in the late 60s, and it definitely connects through to today. That impact is still felt today, and it's all a result of very deliberate design.
Kyle Osbring there, speaking to Monocle's Josh Fennert about the exhibition California Designing Freedom. It's on at London's Design Museum until October 15th. Now, we've spoken to many architecture firms here on Section D, but few are of the same scale as Gensler. Headquartered in San Francisco, the firm operates offices across 46 cities in 16 countries and is among the most profitable architecture practices in the United States. Recently, Monocle's business editor Matt Alagaya wrangled a word with Gensler's co-CEO Diane Hoskins during a stopover in London. And they began by discussing the common principles behind such a vast raft of active projects.
I think what is unique and special about our firm is that we do take every project as a separate, individual set of issues and contexts and opportunities and come at it literally without any preconceived notions. And in that way, we're really able to create a solution for that client that really does address all of the aspirations that they have, the issues of context in the community, obviously budget, schedule, all the other things, long-term, short-term, and, you know, again, I think it's what sets our work apart. But when you do talk about what cuts across all of the projects, and I think there are some things that cut across all the projects, you know, we really believe strongly that our work should enhance the human experience. And there's lots of ways to do that. And obviously, the opportunity to do that has varying degrees in various projects. But at the end of the day, that's what we consider a successful project, is that when it does enhance the human experience of the individuals and the communities that will use that place.
You mentioned that you put a lot of investment and of time and money into research. Yeah. When you look to the future, to the next, you know, 10, 20 years, what are the key trends and developments that you think will shape cities more than anything else? I mean, is it going to be driverless cars or is it different planning laws? I mean, what are the things that you think will really change the way we build our cities going forward?
I can say what I hope will be those things. You know, I think that at the end of the day, there are so many factors that drive cities. And again, they vary so much when you go from city to city and country to country, and they should. But there are some interesting trends or potential trends that could have good impacts, good outcomes. In any case, they will certainly create change and start causing us to think differently about built form if some of these trends play out. One of those would be the driverless car. And there are so many different design decisions that one needs to start thinking about to anticipate how we will accommodate the driverless car. So some of those are, right now we drive these cars into the cities and we park them somewhere. And so, you know, what do you do with these parking spaces that potentially will be empty in prime real estate or even in a building where, you know, the many of the floors are parking and then you've got office on top. So we've been looking at that issue quite a bit because we work with developers who are looking at buildings that they're anticipating that'll get built in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years. Well, we're all anticipating that this driverless car phenomena is probably in the 5, 10, 15 year range. Well, buildings should be there 20, 30, 50 years. So if you are planning a building today, you need to be thinking about this. It needs to affect how you would design the parking in particular. One thing that we're all thinking about is, okay, today it's parking, tomorrow it's something else. It's either retail, or it's office space, or it's potentially residential. So really understanding it more as this transition. The other thing, which honestly I have not yet heard a real solution around, is the drop-off. Okay, so we're all in these driverless cars, we're getting dropped off in front of buildings. You know, what building has enough space for this kind of thing where 500 people are going to need to queue up to get dropped off, right? So, you know, again, starting to anticipate how parking, how the drop-offs will work. I think the other piece is, of course, the intersection with public transit or mass transit, either fixed guide rail, people movers, or bus lines, or biking, or just walking paths. How do you really create more of a system? I mean, if you were going to create a city today and really apply more of a systems thinking, it would be how you start to have kind of mass transit doing the long hauls and then maybe the individual autonomous vehicles doing more of those short connectors. You know, again, how that will come together will be fascinating and really does need design professionals to really engage in this conversation. So we've been out there quite a bit having these dialogues with people coming up with the technology as well as, you know, developers and others who really do want to start to anticipate how this is going to work. And frankly, it creates huge opportunity if we think about, you know, today it's a parking lot, but tomorrow it can have another economic use.
You mentioned before that that Gensler works in 90 countries, 90 plus countries, which is extraordinary. Where do you feel like you're doing some of your most exciting work at the moment? I mean, which region? Is it Africa or is it Southeast Asia? you feel like you're really being challenged in an interesting way and creating some really exciting work?
Well, it is very hard to say one over the other. I think we are seeing amazing work happening everywhere. And I guess in some respects, maybe that's the change. You know, you used to see the drive toward the more creative work out of, like, you know, London and New York and San Francisco. But I think what we're seeing is that even in smaller cities, that the clients we are working with are looking for a level of innovation and creativity that is on par with, you know, something you'd see in you know, any of the kind of creative centers around the world. It's interesting the effect of, I guess, travel, the internet, and, you know, people are just much more informed. Clients are much more aware and are really able to engage at a very different level when we are brought on board to really start to shape a vision. And often it's coming from something from thousands of miles away, something they've seen or they've experienced. So I think the answer is it is extraordinary, the level of innovation that we're able to bring to every assignment these days. And the fact of, you know, this fascinating kind of local concept, but the fact is that same client also wants to understand what's going on globally. That, you know, what is happening in this type of a project that you're seeing in other places around the globe. So that kind of benchmarking and kind of rich conversation from a global standpoint is why also, you know, we are unique, and I think uniquely successful, because we are very much rooted in our local markets and focused on, you know, that context, but really bringing to the table that lens and that experience that is able to really help that client see what's going on, what might be relevant to them, and, you know, again, end up with solutions that are extraordinarily innovative and creative.
Diane Hoskins there, co-CEO of San Francisco-based Gensler Architects, speaking to Monocle's own Matt Alagaya. If you're old enough to remember that album art didn't always appear on a backlit screen, then you've likely come across the work of Aubrey Powell. In 1967, Powell co-founded the album cover design firm Hypnosis with collaborator Storm Thurgeson. And over the next 15 years, the duo dreamed up record covers for the likes of Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, and Paul McCartney, with many of their striking designs becoming as iconic as the music itself. Recently, The Smart Souls at Thames & Hudson published a retrospective of the firm's work in a handsome title named Vinyl Cover Album Art. Aubrey joined Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan to tell the stories behind his artful images.
Hypnosis started when Storm Thorgerson, my partner, and myself began to take some photographs while we were both at college. He was at the Royal College of Art. And actually, I was working at the BBC, freelancing as a designer there. And for some reason or other, we needed money. You know, we were broke. So photography somehow sort of came into circulation with us, and we started shooting book covers.
Give me an idea of what the economy of freelance design was at the time. Did either of you have conventional design backgrounds? How were you getting in touch with clients?
Neither of us had conventional design backgrounds at all. On the contrary, I hadn't really worked in that area whatsoever, but I was very good as a painter. And I don't mean painter and decorator, I mean as a painter. So I had a very good, you know, way of visualization and abilities to deal with perspective and illustration and stuff like that. Storm, on the other hand, was a filmmaker, amateur, but had made some very, very good films in college. And consequently, somehow, the two of us gelled together quite well.
Obviously, it sounds like you initially kind of stumbled into the field. But I wonder, when you began to design them at a greater rate, how did you approach the vinyl album cover as a design object? And how did you develop your practice in relation to that?
First of all, it was by accident that we fell into the business at all. Pink Floyd were looking for an album cover, and they wanted something that was a little different, a little radical, something that was more off the wall. The first album cover they'd had done was a portrait, and they weren't interested in that. It didn't match their style or their music, and they didn't want to be pop stars in that way. So Storm put his hand up, and the next thing we knew, we were doing an album cover for them. And the first one was Saucer Full of Secrets, which is a kind of montage and a collage of science fiction images from Marvel Comics, Apothecary, planetary imagery, and a tiny little photograph of the band in infrared, because the record company insisted, and at that time we didn't have the power, and nor did Pink Floyd, to say no. Once we'd done one album cover, the manager of Pink Floyd said, hey, I've got loads of other people you can work for, like Mark Bolan, the Pretty Things, all sorts of big name groups were around at the time, and suddenly we found ourselves shooting record covers. The beauty of an album cover, which of course you don't have now, it was a fantastic canvas. It was 12 inches by 12 inches, or if it was a gatefold sleeve, 24 inches by 12 inches. And that's a big picture. So it gave us an opportunity to not only experiment, but also to have big visuals that people could see. And although there's an argument between, is this pop art, is this commercial art, is this fine art, Hypnosis, I think, really regarded ourselves as fine artists because we didn't stick to the norm. By and large, we didn't take portraits of groups. We thought laterally. We thought what would be an interesting picture, often unrelated to the music, lyrics, or the band. It was more to do with the art and what would be eye-catching and what would appeal to us as an image rather than anybody else. And luckily, all those bands we worked for, particularly the bigger bands like Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Paul McCartney, they all liked our ideas and liked having something that was alternative and very different from what had been the norm, which was a shot of the group.
Could you tell me about two or three specific examples where you feel that you were particularly successful in addressing the form of the vinyl album cover as a design object?
I think one of the most successful album covers that we created was Atom Heart Mother for Pink Floyd, which was simply a photograph of a cow standing in a field. And this was very radical at the time and, you know, it was extremely unpopular with the record company. Well, I remember we took the photograph, took it to show the band, and immediately Roger Waters said, "That's it, that suits Atom Heart Mother," which was the title of the album. I walked into the record company and they said, "Where's the title? Where's the name of the band?" And I said, "There isn't any. That's it. That's what you've got, a picture of a cow." And of course, you know, ruffled a lot of feathers. But we stood our ground and we had the support of Pink Floyd. And I remember going to Los Angeles and seeing it on Sunset Strip on a huge billboard. And it was so impressive, with nothing to see other than this picture of a cow just sitting there for weeks and weeks. And then on the day of release, they put the word Pink Floyd, Atom Heart Mother on it. And everybody was talking about it. It was just, you know, who is that? What is that? What's this mean? And somehow it was a way, again, I say lateral thinking, but it was a way, a sort of psychological reverse from what was the norm. And consequently, it became a huge hit for them and a big hit for us. And then that led on to things like Dark Side of the Moon, which was remarkably different. And I think at the point where we made Dark Side of the Moon, our careers escalated completely.
What about an example where you actually played with the physical form of the vinyl album?
Another thing that you could do with vinyl was you could take the cover and you could actually recreate, either by cutout, imagery on it, or by physical differences. For example, I remember doing something for the Edgar Broughton Band, which was a Japanese book that folded out and folded out and folded out and folded out. And we'd seen it as a piece of origami. And I remember going to the record company and saying, "This is what we'd like to do." And in those days, because there was so much money sloshing about in the world of records, they were quite open to doing stuff like that. You know, it was not a problem. Or I remember doing an album cover for a band called Bad Company, which is called Rough Diamonds, and I wanted a serrated edge all the way down it. And it wasn't a problem. You'd be hard-pressed to do that now. Another example would be Led Zeppelin. We put the album out in through the outdoor in a brown paper bag. And the way that happened was that the manager, Peter Grant, said, "You know, your expensive album covers that you're doing, you know, who needs them? I could sell Led Zeppelin in a brown paper bag." And I said, "Okay, so why don't we?" So we did. People could call it tricksy or cutesy, but actually, you know, it was intelligently thought through and quite deliberate.
Aubrey Powell there, speaking to Henry Rees Sheridan. Vinyl cover album art is out now and published by Thames & Hudson. That's it for this week. Thank you to our editor, Alex Funnell, and this week's producer, Henry Rees Sheridan. If you have any comments, then feel free to write to incoming producer Ben Rylan at br@monocle.com or Josh Fennert at jaf@monocle.com. He will be back at the same time next week. And remember, you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. Please do leave us a review. It helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Yolaine Goffin. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.